Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, March 31st, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with a From the Editor column, and that will lead into the cover story. Then I'll read Points of Progress. Science and Nature is AWOL again, so I'll substitute the explainer. Then I'll read the Home Forum, and then finally, the Monitor's View. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled A Tribute to the Monitor's Everything Editor. This is written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. And you can email her at swann@csmonitor.com. And she writes, When I came to the Monitor in 2013, I was immediately impressed by Amelia Newcomb. Her poise and candor were unparalleled, and the gentle but firm way that she steered her team was inspiring. But nothing prepared me for the day that I discovered what Amelia is truly made of. On January 16, 2016, the newsroom learned, along with the rest of the world, that Amelia's son, Matt Trevithick, had just been released from an Iranian prison. Matt had been detained while studying Farsi in Tehran and held for 40 days. In the background, Amelia had been working to secure his release. But at work, she continued to bring her usual dedication, focus, and encouraging cheer. She showed the same calm strength through the kidnapping of Monitor freelancer Jill Carroll by Iraqi insurgents a decade earlier, recalls editor Krista Case Bryant, who, as a junior staffer, watched Amelia's unflappable care for Jill's family during her 82-day captivity. Over the years, I've come to learn this is simply who Amelia is, graceful, steadfast, and ever devoted to the Monitor. This spring, after more than 30 years at the Monitor, Amelia will be retiring. Her mark on this publication and its staff will linger far longer. I'm not sure I've ever seen someone who loves the Monitor more than Amelia, says Mark Sappenfield, who enlisted her as managing editor when he began his stint as editor in 2017. When you're working with someone like that, that can be very fortifying. Back then, Amelia was often the only female leader in the room. As such, she made a point of elevating the work of careers of other women. At the same time, she became an advocate for everyone on staff. Ken Kaplan, our Middle East editor, describes her as an everything editor in a note about her influence. He credits her with dealing with our mission, our daily functioning, our philosophy, personnel decisions, the daily care and feedings of the staff, literally with cookies, and jumping into the hurly-burly of headlines and edits, all while maintaining a professional persona that balanced steely resolve with warm nurturing. She has mentored countless staffers. I just feel like every time I interact with Amelia, I learn something, whether it's in a passing conversation or as she's leading a meeting, says Sophie Hills, an early career reporter who covers religion. One of the reasons it's so easy to learn from Amelia is just how much she loves learning herself. Her insatiable curiosity makes her a shrewd editor with impeccable news judgment. She seems to know about everything happening in the world, says Sarah Miller-Lana, the Monitor's deputy international news editor. That curiosity has also made her a compassionate and engaged boss. I feel like Amelia is such a natural mentor, says Lindsay McGinnis, the Monitor's Asia editor. As the youngest editor on the international desk, staffed by veteran journalists, Lindsay was a bit intimidated to join the team. But from the start, she felt that she had an ally in Amelia. She's just so approachable, so knowledgeable, so intelligent about the world and about journalism, but not in a way that makes you scared to ask her a question, Lindsay said. What a privilege to have had this very practical, insightful, career-focused professional guidance. So many of us agree. And that was the From the Editor column written by Noelle Swan, who is the editor of the weekly edition. And this week it was entitled, A Tribute to the Monitor's Everything Editor. And now for the cover story. This week it's entitled, Can Free Cash End Poverty in Malawi? They're finding out. A direct payment program in this landlocked African democracy focuses on personal empowerment and choice. This is written by Erica Page, who is a staff writer. And there is that paragraph here that says why we wrote this. It's got a heading of innovation. Malawi is one of the most persistently poor nations on earth. One nonprofit is testing an idea. What happens when you give every adult a substantial sum of cash and then let them do with it what they want? No strings attached. From Lilongwe Rural, Malawi, last May, with no more fanfare than a buzz of inexpensive cell phones, Nelson Mbazuma and Margaret Zoleyela found themselves staring at an amount of money they never imagined would be theirs. 935,000 Malawian kwachas each. That's about $550, more than what most people in the village of Chigowo, one of thousands of similar villages that dot the plains of central Malawi, could hope to earn in a year. Down the dirt road, neighbors were already celebrating identical text messages. Some shouted and danced. Others raced to the market immediately to buy maize. As village chief, Mr. Mbazuma always carries himself with as much grace as he can muster. That day, however, he felt himself walking differently. Majestically, he recalls. When night fell, the husband and wife knelt on their clay floor. Ms. Zoyela remembers every word she prayed. God, you have given us this money we did not work for. This is your love. Where this money is coming from, we do not know. It is you who knows. Give us wisdom to use this money prudently. The money deposited into their newly established mobile money account is part of an ongoing bold experiment in the world of international development and aid organizations. The concept is simple. The best way to bring people out of poverty is to give them money and let them decide for themselves what they need. No strings attached. Malawi, a small landlocked nation in southern Africa, is one of the poorest countries in the world. Nations like the United States, as well as hosts of non-governmental organizations, have been working here for decades, collectively pouring billions into the country for specific programs to improve health, education, and infrastructure. Malawi has long been a puzzle. However, in general, the nation, with a population of 21 million people, has enjoyed a peaceful history since its post-colonial independence in the 1960s. Since 1995, it has been a viable multi-party democracy. But little has changed. The number of people living in extreme poverty has only grown, according to the World Bank. Today, about 70% of the population still lives in extreme poverty, defined as living on less than $2.15 a day. For every three Malawians able to crawl out of poverty over the last decade, four fell in again because of weather shocks, especially drought. So it's time for new ideas, many development thinkers say. There is a desire to innovate, says Isabel Pelley, Director of Senior Partnerships for Give Directly, the nonprofit behind the cash delivered to the villagers in Chigowo. The concept of cash transfers is not new, especially in parts of Latin America and Africa, where organizations have often used small sums as a cushion against the worst effects of poverty. But the architects of this idea believe that simply giving people hard cash to spend as they see fit could possibly change the course of the country's long history of poverty. If successful, the idea could transform the concept of aid and development and help millions of Malawians help themselves out of poverty. If it fails, it will be added to a list of well-intentioned yet misguided attempts to fix Malawi from the outside in. In late 2023, when Give Directly staff members first arrived in Chikawa, the entire village gathered around Mr. Mbazuma's home. Some villagers were not sure they were hearing the proposal correctly. Give Directly would transfer every adult over the age of 18 a sum of $550? Yes, they were told, and they could use it however they pleased, but the nonprofit would not be coming back with more. To the villagers of Chigowo, it sounded too good to be true. But the offer of free money could not be turned away, and they decided to trust these outsiders in their beige vests and green Give Directly caps. In the months that followed, every resident of the village was enrolled in a door-to-door interview. Anyone who needed a cell phone received one, and Give Directly helped those without national ID sign up for one to register for mobile money. After months of waiting, as well as one of the worst droughts in recent history, the money arrived in May 2024. Mr. Mizuma decided he had to wait until his heart was calm before he even thought about spending the cash. It took over a week. Then he and Ms. Zolayela got to business. They paid back a loan they had taken out to buy 4 bags of maize and then bought several more. They bought a cow for themselves and a calf to give to their daughter in a nearby village that had not been put on Give Directly's list. And then they watched their own village take on new life around them. Thatched roofs needed constant repair and were replaced by steel sheets that should last over a decade. Sturdy brick houses sprouted up next to cramped, crumbling homes. New shops opened in the market, and plump goats began to graze in the pasture. Neighbors started riding to and from the fields on bicycles, and even some motorcycles. Some bought ox carts to haul their harvest. Children who had left school began attending again, their parents able to afford their fees. "It feels good to live here now," says Mr. Mizuma, from a plastic chair on his front porch, his house painted a fresh white. Many who work with Give Directly see its cash model as a form of humility. They also believe it upends the conventional role of a development expert. "We don't necessarily know what's best," says Grace Jackson, the organization's country director for Malawi. "Those living in poverty," she says, "should be able to make those decisions for themselves." The nonprofit's focus on personal empowerment and cash with no strings attached has helped it explode in popularity in the charitable world over the past decade. In 2009, 4 Harvard and MIT graduate students wanted to start an NGO that could circumvent some of the known problems in international development. Too much aid intended to help people they believed was either disappearing along the way or simply not working. Instead of building hospitals or training farmers, they decided they would send money directly to the world's poorest households. Early results were promising, and philanthropists were impressed. Google gave Give Directly a $2.4 million grant to expand to other countries in 2012. By 2021, the development organization was named the fastest-growing nonprofit in the world, with donors including Elon Musk, Jack Dorsey, and the IKEA Foundation. The organization has sent over $900 million in direct cash payments to about 1.6 million people who live in some 24 poverty-ridden nations around the world. It tracks the impact of its efforts with the help of economists. Staff members say the result is an organization that has the excitement and agility of a startup compared with what they see as the old-school development agencies. "There is a level of ambition that's actually data-driven and evidence-based," says Ms. Pelly at Give Directly's office in Nairobi, Kenya. In 2017, the organization started the world's largest and longest universal basic income experience in rural Kenya. Some villages began receiving either a short-term or long-term monthly sum of $22.50, while others got $500 all at once. Early results suggested the one-time lump sum was more likely to turn lives around. It allowed recipients to invest in starting businesses they could not otherwise afford. So that is what Give Directly decided to do in Malawi, calculating that $550 would be enough to, hypothetically, close the poverty gap. So far, it has sent direct payments to more than 71,000 people, or every adult in the entire sub-district of Kangami. "This is a different ballgame," says Dan Stein, a World Bank economist who studied cash transfers in several East African countries. "We know that cash has these great immediate effects on people's lives," he said. Whether it pulls you out of poverty long term is still a little bit of a question mark. Malawi's leaders, too, say they are ready for a new model of development. Yearly income per capita was just $464 last year, according to the International Monetary Fund. Foreign aid makes up 1/5 of gross national income and 2/5 of the national budget, making Malawi one of the most aid-dependent nations in the world. We're tired of being recipients of aid and resources that do not last and do not change the status quo, says Simplex Chidiola Banda, Minister of Finance and Economic Affairs. The issue became more urgent when U.S. President Donald Trump froze U.S. Agency for International Development funds in January. Countries like Malawi were left scrambling. The nation has received $350 million annually from USAID. Yet some Malawi saw the massive cuts as a blessing in disguise. The 60 years of depending on donor aid haven't helped us, says Tom Kanji, a spokesperson for the National Planning Commission, which wrote the latest economic blueprint for the country, Malawi 2063. Its stated goal is aiming for the nation to be an inclusively wealthy and self-reliant industrialized upper-middle-income country. Along with homegrown economic production, it also calls for a hate for handouts. Maybe we need this kind of shock to wake us up from the slumber, says Mr. Kanji. He tries to get his fellow Malawians to remember a time before the colonial era, when their forebears got by without any outside support. It may have been in a primitive way, but we were self-sufficient, he says. Give Directly is careful to distinguish itself from other aid organizations whose plaques line the streets of Lilongwe, Malawi's capital. The nonprofit views its cash transfers not as handouts perpetuating a cycle of dependency, but as a starting capital that recipients can use to invest in a new life. If everything else has been done so far that has not worked, perhaps it's time for something different, says Yvonne Murundiwa, a Give Directly program director in Lilongwe. A common belief is that giving people cash makes them lazy, she adds. The effect is actually the opposite. In the months leading up to transfer day, Peter Kamensa and his family spent every evening debating what they would do when the cash arrived. Among himself, his two wives, and three of his nine children above age 18, the family had $3,300 to consider how to spend. Eventually, the six adults agreed to pool their transfers to open a hardware store. Mr. Kamensa had heard neighbors planning to buy bicycles and motorbikes, and he sensed a business opportunity. When the Give Directly money arrived, Mr. Kamensa rented a storefront off the dusty highway in Kasaya, a village that must be passed to reach more remote places like Chigowo. On a rainy Saturday, customers drop by in a slow but steady trickle, asking for a front axle, a screwdriver, grease, items they would not have needed before Give Directly came to this area when there were few wheeled vehicles in repair or to repair. In the 7 months since the shop opened, Mr. Kamensa has earned a profit of 4 million kwatas, or over $2,300. I have achieved part of my dream, he said. I am independent. The other part will take more time, using that income to put all of his kids through high school. Across the sub-district of Kungani, villagers have seen a similar boost. 3 months after the money arrived, the number of solar panels tripled and steel roofs doubled, according to Give Directly surveys. Households with small businesses have increased by 50%, and the number of people earning more than a dollar a day has doubled. The organization also found out that 9 of the 10 recipients were living above the extreme poverty line after receiving the cash, compared with only 2 out of 10 before. These results mirror short-term studies of direct cash payments from other parts of the world. Improvements in income, nutrition, health, school attendance, and overall well-being usually follow an influx of unconditional cash. In Kenya, starting in 2014, Give Directly gave one-time cash transfers of $1,000 to more than 10,500 poor households in over 650 villages, chosen at random. The cash infusion represented 15% of local economic activity. By 2017, researchers found that for every dollar given, the total economic impact in local areas was $2.50. Fewer studies, however, have considered the long-term impact of such payments, which is why researchers are watching the Malawi experiment closely. How strong is it, and how long can it last? Asked Mr. Stein, the former World Bank economist, can it really cause these grand, long-term step changes in an economy versus a bump that very slowly goes back to the norm over time? In 2008, the government of Uganda offered one-time cash grants of $400 to thousands of young Ugandans to help them learn skilled trades. 4 years later, employment levels of these young Ugandans were 17% higher than their peers, and they earned 38% more. When researchers came back after 9 years, however, those gains had largely dissipated. In a study from Ethiopia, some young people were given $300 in a few days of business training, while others were given factory jobs and some received nothing. Those who received cash were initially earning a third more than the other groups. But after 5 years, these differences disappeared. Many of the problems that countries like Malawi face require government coordination. Cash grants cannot build roads or hospitals, install the infrastructure needed for industries to emerge, or fix systemic corruption. Some economists point out that in theory, as people become economically empowered, they can push for these kinds of improvements in infrastructure and eventually contribute to the tax base that could fund them. In the village of Mitsindo, a few miles down a muddy road from Mr. Kamensa's hardware store in Kasia, Marlon Fanta and Moses Nyamulani laugh when they open the door to the mud hut that used to be their home. The young couple had lived there with their two children. Now, two goats bray inside. It also houses a new outhouse. The ramshackle structure stands just a few steps from their new home, a brick house where they sleep for the first time ever in a separate room from their children. Rain pounds the steel sheets overhead. The maize flour Miss Fanta is grinding in a corner would not have survived the downpour in their former home. And they no longer need to spend close to $100 a year replacing and repairing a thatched roof. We never imagined we could live like this, says Ms. Fanta. Initially, GiveDirectly selected the poorest families in the villages for cash transfers. Now it gives cash to everyone, a strategy that minimizes conflicts between neighbors. Still less than a year after the sudden cash infusion, economic activity has slowed, villagers say. Joyce Lemon runs a tea room in Tsingdawakuda, another small village in the area. On a recent morning this past January, she's pouring a cup of sweet black tea for a single customer, while her son, Ezekiel, kneads dough for scones in a plastic tub. The local market is just waking up. Men are already playing boa, a traditional board game sitting around tables outside as vendors lay out plastic sheets to protect dried fish from the rain. Ms. Lemon says customers crammed around her long wooden table last year after the money arrived. She used to sell a full batch of scones in a day. Now it takes 3 days. The money ran out, she says. Those who had no plans, they squandered it. A widow with five children, Ms. Lemon urged her two of her three adult sons to think about their futures after they received their cash. But she says they were more interested in buying clothes. I was over the moon, recalls Ezekiel, his white knockoff Nikes creased from use since he bought them last year. But at age 18, he was not sure exactly what to do with the money. Having left school at 13, he chose to buy a bicycle and a tiny plot of land to farm, and gave his mother money to buy an extra goat for herself. The rest of the $550 disappeared quickly, he says. Most evidence suggests recipients of cash tend to not spend it frivolously. Even if they did, according to the Keynesian school of economic thought, such cash infusions are not necessarily a bad thing. It's not like the people selling the beer are going to dig a hole in the ground and bury the money, says Boniface Dulini, a political scientist at the University of Malawi. If there is more money in the economy, it's always a good thing. The economic philosophy is propelling similar programs in the West, too. Starting July 1, 2023, all babies born into low-income families in Connecticut will receive $3,200 invested by the government, growing to between $11,000 and $24,000 by age 18 for education, training, housing, or retirement. California is offering foster children $4,500 upon adulthood. Some politicians in Spain have proposed 20,000 euros, or about $21,743, for every young adult. But when it comes to money, problems can arise. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, GiveDirectly staff allegedly took an estimated $900,000 intended for recipients by stealing SIM cards registered with the cash. There is also concern that cash transfers could divert government resources away from the communities they are trying to help. In a place like Malawi, government officials are of the mind that every $550 drop counts. It might not be enough, says Mr. Chithiola Banda, the Minister of Finance, but it is a substantial amount to see people moving from step A to step B, from the status of being destitute and having nothing to the status of having something. Lazina T. Kajadula was not able to take part in the cries of joy last year when the $550 arrived. Her village in Kambi lies just outside the sub-district of Kongoni, where GiveDirectly was given cash to every adult. She's had to fend for herself, her daughter, who is just beginning school, and a newborn son. Like most of the adults in Kambi, the 22-year-old had grown used to her own gnawing hunger, but she could not bear to see it in her children. As friends and relatives in villages a 15-minute walk away put new roofs on their homes and fed meat to their children, she begged a nearby farmer for work. Every cent she earned went towards buying sugar cane to resell at the market. For more than three painstaking months, she saved enough to get her business started. A load of bricks, several bundles of thatch, a bag of black tea leaves. By last November, she had built her own tea room. On a good day, she earns $5. It is not enough, she says, but at least her son and daughter are eating. Around her, the rest of the village is trying to take steps forward, too. Every month, each household contributes 1,000 kwachas, or 58 cents, to provide a schoolroom for the youngest children. Men from the village have built four walls and a blackboard, but it still needs a steel roof. Village chief Tom Matelimanja reasons that if their kids could be better prepared for school, they might have a better chance of pulling their families out of their current conditions. Of the village's 350 households, he says 300 of them eat no more than once a day. Here at the border between sub-districts, where haves and have-nots live so close to each other, onlookers have raised ethical concerns about the experiments conducted by Western development organizations on poor individuals in the global south. The answer, too, can be sterile, if not glib. Randomized controlled trials are the closest thing economists have to scientific experiments. They need them to study the effects on people who receive cash and compare them with others who don't. GiveDirectly staff points out this happens in any development project. If a new school or hospital is built in an area, there is always another region that did not receive one. The organization hopes to one day reach every district in the country. We don't know why they were selected and not us, says Chief Matelimanja. We know that there is a God in heaven, and one day our turn will arrive. When that day comes, he says, they will use the money even more wisely than their neighbors, whose mistakes and challenges they have watched over the past year. Back in Chigawa, life has settled down 8 months after money fell upon the villagers' heads as if from heaven. They still dry their maize on reed mats and grind the kernels into flour for their families. Mr. Mizuma and Ms. Zoyela's lives have undoubtedly improved, but this is still an impoverished region and the money they received is long gone. Ms. Zoyela's back is beginning to stoop. She still wakes up at 5 a.m. every day to till her land. If I stop, what would I be eating, she says. Who is going to take care of me? And there's a bullet here that says Golden Montaga contributed to this report. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for points of progress in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it in a paragraph or two or three or sometimes four describing that point. Number one, United States. An airport is harnessing the wind power of jets at takeoff. The American company Jet Wind Power uses giant turbines to capture forceful air from planes and transforms it into electricity. Dallas Love Field has served as a testing ground since 2021. 5 solar-powered turbine pods on the tarmac collect wind, which has started powering device charging stations in the terminal in November. 8 more pods will follow. Patrick Carino, Dallas's director of aviation, says the electricity is equivalent to what's needed in 100 homes annually. JetWind reports strong interest in the technology from several other countries. That was from New Mobility and Kara News. Number 2, Trinidad and Brazil. Carnival is becoming more sustainable. In Brazil, the Ministry of Tourism this year expected 53 million participants for the world's largest carnival celebration, the beloved festival before the season of Lent, and that also results in tons of waste. But recycling efforts are working to change that. In Trinidad, nonprofit Carnicycle has since 2018, collected and recycled costumes that otherwise would have gone to a landfill. It then sells those materials to costume designers and partygoers. Similarly, Sessenta Carnival in Rio de Janeiro both donates and resells the used elaborate costumes. In New Orleans, a growing number of organizations focus on recycling the plastic trinkets and extra glass and aluminum trash from the season. In 2024, the coalition reported collecting 12,697 pounds of Mardi Gras beads and small souvenirs that are thrown from parade floats. And that was from the BBC, the Rio Times, CGTN, and New Orleans and Company. Number 3 is Finland. Finland is a leader in putting innovative climate solutions to work, especially new heating methods. Since 2022, a southwestern town has been partly powered by a sand battery, in which low-grade sand in a silo stores heat. A new unit being built will be a larger 1-megawatt battery that can store 100 megawatt hours of thermal energy. In Vantaa, the district heating network will draw from the world's biggest thermal energy storage facility. 3 caverns filled with hot water will store enough energy to warm Finland's fourth-largest city for up to a year. North of the Helsinki-Vantaa Airport in Matsala, a data center 100% powered by renewables will recover waste heat for the community. Other efforts include a financial services provider offering 437 million euros, or about $475 million, in loans to small businesses for sustainability measures. Critics say that Finland should be cautious about the greater dependence on biomass for energy in the center-right government's plan. But a recent study also ranked Finns as the Europeans most knowledgeable about climate change and how to address it. That was from Talking Climate, The Progress Playbook, and Climate Change Performance Index. Number 4 is Kenya. The High Court is restoring citizenship to tens of thousands of ethnic Somali Kenyans incorrectly registered as refugees. An estimated 40,000 nationals were stuck in digital identity systems and for years denied access to education, jobs, and legal marriage. In Kenya, a national ID is required at age 18, but applications are denied to those whose names persist on lists of refugees, leaving thousands stateless and unable to even enter government buildings without an ID. Between 1991 and 2014, the United States Refugee Agency managed registrations for Somalis at new refugee camps in Kenya, personal information that was shared with the country. Registrants included people born in Kenya who were not true refugees but struggled to find food and shelter at a time when aid was only available at the camps. The court's finding that the Kenyan government violated the rights of thousands of Kenyans by denying them citizenship for years is a positive step, says Yusuf Bashir, executive director of Haki na Sheria, meaning justice and law in Swahili, an initiative that defends the rights of marginalized northern communities in Kenya. And that was from Human Rights Watch. And last but not least, number 5, Japan. A fourth high court ruled that Japan's lack of recognition for same-sex marriage is unconstitutional, amping up pressure on parliament to legalize the practice. Since 2019, plaintiffs have won 9 out of 10 lawsuits against the government for not recognizing same-sex marriages, though such decisions do not alter the law. At the Nagoya High Court, presiding Judge Nobuhiro Katada ruled that Japan's current laws constitute legal discrimination based on sexual orientation without rational basis, but stopped short of a monetary redress. Japan's Supreme Court is expected to rule on the issue later this year. In a 2020 Pew Research Center survey on whether homosexuality should be accepted by society, 68% of Japanese respondents agreed. Support is higher among younger generations, with 92% of Japanese between 18 and 29 responding yes. And that was from the Japan Times, the Associated Press, and Pew Research Center. And all that was compiled by Cameron Poo and Troy Aiden Sabajan, who are staff writers. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, science and nature is AWOL again, so I will read the explainer from the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week it's entitled, Uncle Sam as Investor, Why America is Considering a Sovereign Wealth Fund. This is written by Lauren Belsey, who is a staff writer. Early in February, President Donald Trump ordered the Treasury and Interior Departments to come up with a plan for a sovereign wealth fund for America. Many nations have SWFs, as they are known, which are essentially giant state-owned investment portfolios. But questions about how America would amass resources for such a fund, direct investment decisions, and ensure ethical practices are critical ones. President Trump says an SWF could play an important role in economic development, in public finance, and even in potentially buying TikTok, the social media platform whose U.S. future hangs in the balance. Does the idea make sense for the United States? What follows is a question and answer piece. Question: why would a country want an SWF? Answer: a sovereign wealth fund can help a nation stabilize its economy, build savings, and generate long-term financial returns. Like any investor, a nation can create a portfolio of stocks, bonds, real estate, or other assets, and, assuming those investments make money, reap the returns year after year. The portfolio can also be structured to boost economic development, as the White House announced February 3rd, to promote fiscal sustainability, lessen the burden of taxes on American families and small businesses, establish long-term economic security, and promote U.S. economic and strategic leadership internationally. Question: do such funds work? Answer: yes, they can when structured well. Successful funds can pay for national programs without raising taxes. They can buffer against the unexpected or ensure that future generations will have adequate financial resources. Of the more than 90 nations with one or more SWFs, Norway is the star. In 35 years since the SWF's formation, it has invested more than $1.8 trillion of its oil revenue into the fund, and it has reaped another $1.8 trillion in investment returns. In a way, we found oil twice, once on the oil-rich continental shelf and then again in financial markets, quipped Nicole Tangen, head of the investment firm that manages the fund, in Washington last year. Question: how are SWFs funded? Answer: the seed money for these funds comes from excess government revenue. Often governments, Norway and Saudi Arabia, use the income they make from oil drilling or minerals mining. Others, like China, use the money they make from trade surpluses. That's also one reason many analysts poo-poo the idea of an American SWF. The U.S. almost always runs annual deficits, not surpluses, and has a mountain of debt. But other analysts are more optimistic. The administration says an SWF could be funded by selling off some of the $5.7 trillion the federal government directly holds in land and other assets, or the much larger sum of indirect assets, such as natural resource reserves. The Treasury Department has appointed J.R. Gibbons as a senior advisor for the U.S. SWF. Mr. Gibbons previously worked for the Defense Department's recent effort to attract private capital to invest in areas critical to national defense. Question: Are there pitfalls? Answer, plenty. A fund can make or lose money depending on how the individual investments in that fund perform. If the fund managers aren't fully independent, government officials can use the SWF money for their own political ends. If the funds can be invested in domestic assets, such big investments can distort the economy. If the fund managers aren't fully transparent about where the money is invested, it can lead to fraud. That's what happened to Malaysia's SWF a decade ago when allegations of an estimated $4.5 billion siphoned off for lavish spending toppled the then prime minister, who ended up in prison as a result of the scandal. More subtle forms of corruption and cronyism can also emerge. If you have government officials with huge investment authority, people are going to want to sway their views, says Daryl West, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And the final question, does an SWF make sense for the U.S.? And the final answer, the idea of an American SWF is generating increasing attention since President Trump suggested it as a vehicle to purchase TikTok, the Chinese social media site. Starting with some $2 trillion, which could make it the world's largest, an American SWF could, number one, support U.S. infrastructure renewal, and number two, develop strategic mineral mining in the U.S., and number three, replace corporate taxes and fund startups that would maintain America's technological edge over China. But many analysts remain skeptical. It is not a traditional conservative idea, says Mark Wachowski, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. More details will emerge in early May when the Treasury and Interior Departments are expected to report back with a plan. And now for the home forum in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly, there is one article, and I will read it. It's entitled, Good Garden Shears Make Good Neighbors. I loved the privacy of my green fortress until we hacked the hedge and opened up our world. This is written by Murr Brewster. I bought the old house with the double lot in 1978. The neighborhood was affordable, which is to say, undesirable. The ambience of the nearby commercial street owed much to the iron gates and plywood. There were only three working business establishments, all of them taverns, that loudly disgorged their patrons at 2 a.m. That first year, we swept up a lot of broken glass inside. Our new TV walked out after 3 days. We had our insurance agent's phone number memorized. I'd been an apartment dweller, and I was thrilled to have a place all my own. But I kept to myself. I didn't even want to meet my neighbors. This felt so permanent. What if they were weird or chatty? I'd be stuck with them. The big side yard was bordered on two sides by a sprawling laurel hedge with Godzilla's own ambition. It didn't grow so much as it reared up. I caught one neighbor pouring used motor oil underneath the hedge, but that did nothing to discourage the thing. Within a year, it was a threat to migrating geese. I loved it. My green fortress sealed me off from the street. I could garden all day under its increasingly massive shadow and imagine the world contained just me, my husband Dave, and my starter set of flowering perennials. Meanwhile, Dave amused himself by building a 4-foot-tall masonry wall for the front yard with fancy brick arches and built-in flower boxes. You know, he said, squinting, I could build a wall around the whole property if we took down all that laurel. I peered up at the hedge. Why don't you solve world hunger first, I said. But I began to dream of a 7-foot-tall citadel, a haven of brick, a monument to privacy. Slick magazines have been touting the seductions of the garden room, an extension of the house with all its promise of seclusion and retreat. The next few years saw the property values plummet. Taxes even went down. You could buy any house on the block for $20,000, and many for less. It made no difference to us since we had no intentions of selling, but that was a lot of fun to bring up in casual conversation 30 years later. But earnest young people with babies strapped to the chests began to move in all around. Some made art, many made music, and most took turns serving each other coffee in any of the several dozen new establishments. A growing number of our neighbors seemed to have few criminal intentions or none at all. One day, Dave whacked the laurel hedge down to sturdy stumps, like dinosaurs fossilized mid-stride. They leafed out overnight. You're never going to get rid of that hedge, I said. But one day, when I was at work, he did. Using a chain, our 1969 International Harvester pickup truck in first gear, and a borrowed flatbed, the garden opened up, full of new light. I sketched out new flower beds and meandering paths and decided to eliminate the lawn, which had quickly resprouted everywhere there was dirt. You're never going to get rid of all that grass, Dave said. But I did. The price of houses began to seem impossibly high, yet people continued to move in. Baby strollers bloomed on the streets like hope. We met new neighbors and wandering strangers while our hedge, our guard, was down. People approved of the shape the garden was taking. They hailed our progress from the sidewalk. We began to look forward to the boisterous arrival of the woman who strolled by every afternoon walking a bouquet of terriers. Others rested their elbows on our existing wall, gazed into the yard, and commented knowledgeably about soil nutrients and plant combinations. Soon everyone in the neighborhood was on an egg-borrowing basis. Sugar was an easy score, but if you needed a guitar string or a tube of cadmium yellow, those could be found too. Dave was generous with his power tools and skills. New young friends were happy to de-bollocks our recalcitrant computer. But we were the universal donors. We opened the pickup truck. We owned the pickup truck. Did everybody on the block have a key for it? We didn't put gas in a truck for years. One day, Dave stood outside with a pencil behind his ear, ready to order block for the new wall. So, he inquired, his arm elevating, how high do you want it? I rested my elbows on his low starter wall. Right about here, I said. And finally, we're at the Monitor's View in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. These are articles written by the editorial staff, and there are three of them. We'll see how much I get done. I think I might get them all. The first one is The Hard Knocks of Rocketry. 1 year ago, Intuitive Machines became the first private company to land a spacecraft on the moon, but Odysseus ended up on its side, cutting the mission short. In early March, its second moon lander did the exact same thing. In addition, for the second consecutive launch, SpaceX's Starship rocket exploded after reaching space on March 8th. If Shakespeare were to pen a play on the topic, he could fairly write that the course of space exploration never did run smooth. SpaceX founder Elon Musk recently conceded, "Rockets are hard." Failure is never cause for celebration. When humans sit atop rockets, failure is inadmissible. Yet the recent spate of failures tells a different tale. It tells of a renewed effort to do something difficult and the possibilities on the other side of that barrier. In the high-stakes world of space exploration, failures aren't just accidents, they're critical learning opportunities, wrote contributor Ivan Yatskov in Orbital Today. The past year shows the need to build up technical know-how, but as ever, these efforts are about more than space. They are about loosening humanity's sense of limitation. Overcoming our limits is what is hard to do. It's not about the rocket equation. It's not about physics. We solve those issues every single day, said Rick Tumlinson of the Space Fund in the 2015 TEDx talk. Every day, something that was science fiction turns into reality. It's an amazing time, and it's accelerating. Okay, the next Monitor's View article is entitled, A Burst of Justice in Manila. For the past 7 years, the vast majority of countries have seen a decline in rule of law, according to the World Justice Project. Not so the Philippines. Last year, it was one of the few countries whose global ranking rose, even if slightly. Besides making reforms to its justice system, the Southeast Asian nation has now passed a major test. On March 11th, it handed over a former president, Rodrigo Duterte, to the International Criminal Court to face trial on charges of crimes against humanity for years of extrajudicial killings by police and vigilantes that he supported. Reactions among Filipinos hint at gratitude for this example of equality before the law and embrace the universal norms of justice. Mr. Duterte's 2016 to 2022 term as president and an earlier stint as a mayor was a dark chapter for the Philippines. The arrest should not only signal the end of impunity, but ignite a larger movement of justice, transparency, and the restoration of human rights, former Justice Secretary Leila de Lima told Radio Free Asia. The turnaround by the Philippines suggests that public thinking on rule of law can change quickly. While the world faces an increasingly uncertain future, it is somewhat reassuring that a few fundamental norms of international law will continue to hold until a more stable global order is achieved, Eyal Benvenisti, a University of Cambridge law professor, wrote in February for the digital law journal Just Security. For family members of victims killed during Mr. Duterte's reign of terror, the arrest is only the first step. As Representative Jude Asidre of the House of Representatives said, "We owe it to them to make sure that we start healing, but that healing will come only through one thing, through justice." And a third Monitor's View article is entitled, "Armenia Redefines Peace as Within." After multiple territorial wars, Armenia and Azerbaijan, two small countries ringed by big powers, announced March 13th that they agreed on a draft peace agreement. That alone prompted praise across a conflict-riddled Eurasian continent. Yet a portion of the praise went to only Armenia for something else. Following the country's latest military defeat in 2023, Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan not only offered concessions to Azerbaijan, but also launched a campaign at home to lift the national identity. "The real Armenia," he said in February, "resides in all citizens living within the country's recognized borders, ethnic minorities included, as the source of the legal order, along with spiritual values that bring harmony. The supreme bearer of power," he said, "lies in each individual's desire for prosperity, freedom, creativity, justice, and a caring society." Mr. Pashinyan's call for a transformed identity is part of his hope to change the constitution. Since independence in 1991, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Armenia has held three constitutional referendums before finally reaching a popular democratic revolution in 2018. Peace now rests on individuals building up their democracy to end an outsized dependency on other countries. The current Armenian consciousness, Mr. Pashinyan implied, often does not rely on rights and duties. He asked citizens to deepen the skill of reflection. A secure Armenia, in other words, lies in an identity above ethnic bloodlines. Well, we've got some time left, as we often do, so I'll fill it with the global newsstand section of the perspective section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is it names a newspaper, what city it's from, a title, and a paragraph. So here we go. From Yab, Lebanon in Beirut, "Al-Shara broke his promise to bring democracy to Syria." When the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, rebel group ousted former President Bashar al-Assad and interim President Ahmad al-Ashar took power, there was hope that Syria would finally embark on a path to democracy and inclusivity, states an editorial. However, his actions in March have shattered these promises. The massacre of hundreds of Alawites and the attacks on the Druze community are a chilling reminder of the old regime's brutality. Mr. al-Shara appointed himself president without an election, filling his government with HTS loyalists rather than representatives from all Syrian communities. Syria is in desperate need of reconstruction aid. However, this support should not come without conditions. It is time for the world to demand democracy in Syria, not just another name on a throne of oppression. The next one is from The Guardian from London. "Nationalism in Romania is an international issue." A growing nationalist pride movement has driven the meteoric rise of far-right pro-Russia candidate Calin Georgescu, writes Andrei Papavicu, an investigative journalist. Georgescu came from obscurity to win the first round of presidential elections last November, prompting the courts to annul the ballot on suspicion of outside interference. Georgescu's success is symptomatic of a broader trend supported by foreign actors, including Russia, the resurgence of ultra-nationalist movements. In Romania, with three far-right parties holding sway in parliament, this trajectory has a uniquely dangerous edge. It is likely to reshape policy on Romania's relationship with the European Union and its support for Ukraine as it reawakens the ghosts of a fascist past. The next one should be, from the Taiwan News from Taipei, Taiwan. The U.S. needs Taiwan, it just doesn't know it yet. Recent discourse has reignited fears of a potential Taiwan abandonment, writes Ye Chi Ting, founder of the Taiwanese news organization Ketagalan Media. Taiwan should reframe the conversation by emphasizing the immense benefits of a stronger U.S.-Taiwan partnership. Taiwan's chip dominance provides an opportunity for the U.S. to build a secure, high-tech supply chain. A stable Taiwan deters regional conflict, preventing the security vacuum that could otherwise push Japan, South Korea, and others towards nuclear options to counterbalance a diminished U.S. presence. The U.S. should not be asking if Taiwan is worth defending. It should be asking if it can afford not to. The next one is from the NASA Guardian from Nassau, Bahamas, and it's entitled, Space Junk Should Be Dumped Safely. The recent discovery of debris from SpaceX's Starship rocket in Bahamian waters has raised concerns about the potential dangers of space junk landing in the Bahamas, states an editorial. Had this Starship failure resulted in debris falling in a more populated area, the consequences could have been severe. There is also potential for long-term environmental impact of this debris. The exponential increase in rocket launches has led to a rise in defunct satellites and other debris orbiting the Earth, increasing the likelihood of collisions and uncontrolled re-entries. The Bahamas, as a country involved in the Falcon 9 program, should be at the forefront of advocating for stronger global regulations on space debris management. And one more here from Buenos Aires Times from Buenos Aires, Argentina. It says, Argentina's politicians don't know their people. March's extreme flooding in Argentine city Bahia Blanca has exposed once again how disconnected Argentina's political leadership is, writes columnist Eduardo Reina. Lack of suitable infrastructure not only exacerbated the impact of the disaster, but also exposed how disconnected the political leadership is from the real needs of the cities. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.